This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 71 was recorded on October 14th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Julian Brigden is back with us this week. Julian, it seems that geopolitical developments have really turned up since we last had you on the program, particularly the attacks on Abgag, Saudi Arabia. How does that impact your overall analysis of the market?
So it's interesting you bring that up, Eric, because it was just actually a topic that we discussed, or we're just about to discuss, with our Macro Insider client base, the one we service with Raoul. And the reason why is because it really sideswiped the movements in the market. I mean, if you were, particularly in the bond market, we'd had that huge, I mean, almost unprecedented duration grab as that sort of convexity kicked in and forced anyone who had any bond exposure to just scramble for duration over the summer. And then we got down to some ridiculously overextended markets. I mean, I was looking at something stupid and simple like the RSI of 10-year yields in the US got to the lowest levels we'd seen in 20 years, which was, you know, at the depths of the Asian crisis. And we started to get corrections in those, and they were relatively rapid in the same way that they were relatively rapid in yields falling. The yields started to spike. And then, of course, we had events in Saudi Arabia. We had events with the China trade stuff. And we had, I mean, I guess you can call, you know, what was going on in Turkey as well. So we've had a series of macroeconomic and geopolitical stuff, which I think has just sort of killed some of the momentum in the market. But the question is has it utterly killed it, or is it just simply delayed it? My gut seems to suggest to me that really it's delayed it. So I'm more in the sort of corrective camp in some of these fixed income markets. We've been playing it a little bit like that, being short some duration at long end in a sort of smash and grab kind of way, and also looking for things like the steepening trades to come in, because I still look at some of these markets, and I tweeted it, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I looked at, say, this Austrian 100-year bond. I mean, this thing does look to me like an absolute classic bubble chart. So, you know, it's going to get very interesting. And I think as long as the geopolitics sort of sits in the background, it damaged all the momentum for the corrections. But I still think we're in that sort of phase.
Julian, I know you guys do a huge amount of work on global liquidity. Now, back in 2015 and 2016, China was flooding their markets with liquidity. Some analysts think that that action that they took, whether it was a good idea or not in the long run, may have averted a liquidity crisis from going global. So would China's actions in world markets today be a big part of your thesis for what happens next? Is that as important as it was back then?
So, look, China is always immensely important. And there are actually some sort of, you know, embryonic signs of things stabilizing in China. I do think the big difference, Eric, and I'm sure you would probably agree with me, is this is a very different China. I mean, I think if you look at the way that she's spending money and the way that she's directing spending money, because she certainly is, she's loosened liquidity, she's, you know, added some reserves, she's done a whole bunch of stuff. She's allowed, you know, local governments to start issuing debt, and she's talked about this sort of stuff. But I think there's going to be significantly less spillover going forward than there was doing in the past. I mean, obviously, a huge chunk of this is related to the trade tensions. So she doesn't want to just spew liquidity, which ends up benefiting, I mean, essentially her adversaries in this trade fight. So I'm not really one of these people who's in one of the ultra sort of bearish China camps, you know, oh, there are all these excesses, it's all going to blow up. I mean, look, there are inordinate successes, but there's a big advantage of having a centrally planned economy, which we don't have here in the West. But I do think it's fair to say that she's much more domestically focused. And I think then you can't look at her to come to the rescue of a lot of these other places. So we have to start looking at liquidity coming potentially from elsewhere and stimulus coming potentially from elsewhere. And frankly, that's when things get a little bit more problematic because they aren't yet. I mean, you know, we've had the Fed do this repo transaction, which has now become, you know, much more structural. I personally view this more, and I've written this more akin to QE1 than I do, say, QE2 or QE3. I know there's some debate whether it's QE at all, and I think that's fair. I think the Fed's, from a forward guidance perspective, happy to think that the market believes it's QE. But the reason why I see it as more QE1 as opposed to QE2 and QE3 is QE1 was really designed to obviate a negative. And that negative was the collapse of the private sector bank balance sheet in here in the US after the end, after the start of the global financial crisis. And that's really how I see this. This is designed to stop a tightening of commercial bank balance sheets as their prime brokers are forced to take down more and more of the auctions and the treasury issuance. It's very, very different from QE2 and QE3, which were net additions to liquidity. So, you know, there's that, which I guess is a slight positive. There's certainly no fiscal spending here in the US. Certainly won't be anything until 2021. And I think it starts in spades, but that's a long, long way away. And in Europe, I mean, these guys are still, you know, fiddling while Rome is burning, or should we say Berlin is burning at the moment. So I just don't see quite as much stimulus as I would like. I think hopefully we'll get there. I think the Fed can still do more. I hope they will do more. But we're going to see. And as I said, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, China's very important, but it's not as important as it was, I'm afraid, because they aren't doing as much. And what they are doing is more domestically focused as opposed to spilling over and supporting the rest of the world.
Julian, you caught my interest. You just described, I think you're the first person I've heard use the word fair to describe the Fed's characterization of this quantitative addition to their balance sheet that is being supplied for the purpose of providing easing as not being quantitative easing. Help me with the calculus here, because it sounds like you get it. I admit I don't. It sure sounds like QE to me. What am I missing?
So we'd written to clients about this, MI2 clients about this. It's a bit kind of insider baseball-esque for a lot of people. But this was an accident essentially waiting to happen, was our view. And the reason was actually relatively simple, Eric. Post the GFC, what had happened is that the regulations around prime brokers had changed quite dramatically. In the good old days, if you were a prime broker, you know, making markets in treasuries, you used to be able to run as much inventory as you basically wanted, and it didn't really cost you anything. And the reason for that is you could net your bond exposure, longs and shorts, down to zero. Treasuries were pretty much zero risk weighted. You certainly didn't have to put any equity against the book. And then post the GFC, all of that changed. And we'd written about this as one of the reasons why liquidity was drying up in the treasury market, in that the PBs were just not incentivized to hold big trading books anymore and actually run them as tightly as they possibly could. So in the end, that meant that, you know, in the treasury market, you ended up paying a game of basically pass the parcel when anything got traded. You know, there was no big market makers essentially with large inventories and large books to absorb this. So if you fast forward to this year, the problem in the treasury market was that you have seen an inverted curve. Now, and also strong dollar. And that's done two key things. The first thing is it's removed, the inverted curve has removed the cash, what we call the cash and carry buyers of fixed income. So the guys basically who buy, you know, fund themselves in the sort of typically, you know, 2 to 3 month and surf the curve, okay? Because there is no curve to be surfed, right? It's inverted, so they can't do that. So those guys are no longer there. And the second thing is the strong dollar means that central banks have been relatively lackluster buyers of treasuries. That has meant in an environment where treasury has been rebuilding cash balances, where there's an awful lot of treasuries to be issued anyway because of running all this debt, that the prime brokers have been forced, remember, they're obliged to carry more and more inventory. So in an environment where that is part of a big commercial bank's balance sheet, right, you know, JP Morgan's prime brokerage operation has to sit on the balance sheet with every other bit of the business. If this is the business is demanding more capital and more equity to hold against this growing book, which they have no choice but to take on, it risks squeezing out lending elsewhere. And I think that's essentially what the Fed has prevented. That doesn't mean that JP Morgan's balance sheet is growing as it would have done under QE2 and QE3. It just means that you aren't at risk of squeezing out other lending. To me, that's not, you could call it QE1, but that's not necessarily QE2 or QE3, which to me is a big difference. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not unimportant because it prevents or obviates some of the immediate risk that we get a big spike in dollar rates as liquidity gets squeezed out from other areas of the economy. We literally do get, to use the economic term, Eric, crowding out. But it isn't quite the same as, you know, flushing the system with trillions of dollars of new cash.
Well, Julian, I can't thank you enough for another terrific All-Stars appearance. We look forward to getting you back on the show next month for another update. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned to your Macro Voices feed. We've got Stephanie Pomboy coming up as the feature interview on Thursday's Macro Voices podcast. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.